Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Today we are diving back into the Idaho student murders case like never before. Now that the gag order has been lifted, the evidence is finally out and in the open. At least it's slowly making its way there. Joining me, two powerful voices in this case. Howard Bloom, New York Times bestselling author and journalist behind When the Night Comes Falling. It's been ahead of the curve from the start, breaking major revelations and piecing together the deeper story behind the headlines. Also, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the FBI's counterintelligence behavioral analysis unit, here to help us decode the new evidence and what it reveals about Koberger's psychology, motive, and movement. So let's get into it, guys. Thank you both for being here. Howard, I want to start with you and I guess the somewhat elephant in the room that we've seen in the last few days. Donald Trump speaking out about the Brian Koberger case, something I don't think a lot of us expected. Part of his quote saying, while life imprisonment is tough, it's certainly better than receiving the death penalty. But before sentencing, I hope the judge makes Koberger, at a minimum, explain why he did these horrible murders. He also wrote, there are no explanations. There is no nothing. That's a direct quote. Howard, your reactions, Trump coming out and speaking about this.
Well, yeah, I've known Donald Trump. I knew him 100 years ago when I was a reporter at the Times. I did a piece on him back at the tail end of the 1970s. Mm-hmm. He took me to the tennis matches at Forest Hills a couple of times. I remember him picking me up in front of my apartment building in New York City in a long limo, and he was driving the limo himself. His chauffeur was off that day. So, and in the course of those years since then, there hasn't been, I can't think of one other occasion that I've ever agreed with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But today, no matter what his reasons for saying it, perhaps his distraction technique from his other concerns, but his calling on Hitler to take a stand, well, I support that. I don't think Hitler will be moved in the least, but
yeah,
I'm supporting that. I feel, it's a travesty of justice that Koberger can get away with just his terse responses at the sentencing hearing.
especially now that this is sunk in a little bit. We're not just, you know, on that shocking day where Koberger came out and admitted to the guilt. We've had a chance to kind of digest this. We've had a chance to hear the families out, hear what they've had to say and their various reactions to all of this. And, you know, a couple weeks out of this, you know, how are you feeling about this? I mean, this does seem like a travesty, the fact that he's not going, or he doesn't have to say anything. Is that the one thing that can happen here in this case now, is a forced explanation, not just confession, but explanation to try?
I'm not sure how forced it can be. I mean, the judge only has certain legal powers. Koberger is protected by Ann Taylor. Mm-hmm. I don't think he has to say anything. I think all this will remain hidden till he's sitting in his jail cell 10 years from now, and then he'll decide, I'm bored stiff. Why don't I tell all? Why don't I? You know, his vision was to become a forensic psychologist, a criminal justice specialist. Well, sometime down the road, I think he will achieve his lifelong ambition. He will become a forensic psychologist. Other forensic psychologists will come knocking on his jail cell, eager to talk with him.
It's almost like he's getting what he wants. Robin?
Yeah, I agree. And that's the travesty here, is that I think he's going to potentially get exactly what he always wanted. So, Howard, I'm curious about this, and I'm always kind of the glass half full until it spills over anyway. And, you know, the prosecutor, Bill Thompson, has got a really strong reputation of just being hard-nosed. You know, they said he's a hammer with a velvet glove. And all along during the investigation and all that's going on, we've always been a little amazed about how silent he's been or how acquiescence he's been to the defense. But so here's my hope. And this, sometimes I go out on the conjecture thing, but I'm kind of taking in all the data that you've hypothesized with the targeting of Maddie Morgan, Mogan, as well as other people saying the same thing. Here's what I'm hoping. And here's what I'm maybe thinking, again, benefit of the doubt to Bill Thompson on this. Many, many times, upwards to 60 to 70% of the time, when you have a stalking of an individual, so let's presume that Koberger was stalking Maddie and he had targeted her. Many, many times there's journals, there's writings, there's something that goes behind that stalking. And since Koberger's been online earlier in life, kind of talking about his life and everything, I'm holding out hope until not that one of the reasons why Bill didn't go for an explanation is because maybe with the unsealing of documents, we might get some sort of an explanation if it's in there. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that might happen?
I think that's wishful thinking.
I think it is.
inside the velvet glove is a velvet hand, not a hammer. Thompson gave his statement at the plea deal, and his statement was pretty much the same as the first affidavit that was introduced just after Koberger's arrest. Mm-hmm. He had no details there. If he had anything there, he would have, I think, shared it, but he didn't.
What do you think about, I mean, if we were to theorize and say this thing actually did go to trial, which we were all expecting, and Bill Thompson was going to be there as the prosecutor, and now that we know, obviously, Koberger took the plea, how confident are you that this would have been a successful conviction with Bill Thompson behind the wheel?
I think he would have delivered, actually. Yep. I think the DNA evidence was so strong, and then combined with the more circumstantial evidence, it created a mosaic where all the pieces merged, and it could only be Koberger.
Yeah. I want to ask about your thoughts right now, or any insight you might have on the family of Brian Koberger, his parents. Earlier on, when it was announced that Koberger was going to be pleading out, Steve Gonsalves had made a fairly angry statement against the DA and his frustration with him, saying, we know, and I'm paraphrasing here, when the tickets were bought, essentially insinuating that Koberger's family may have had more of a heads up on this plea acceptance than the victims actually did. What's your thoughts on that, and anything you know on that right now about, you know, were they giving a little extra, you know, help to the family of Koberger over the families of the victims themselves when it came to getting this whole thing put together?
I don't know if they were giving extra help. What I think happened was that Ann Taylor was just more expeditious in moving things forward than Bill Thompson was. I mean, she notified the family right away as soon as the plea deal was settled, tell them to get out to Boise. And Bill Thompson just didn't even notify the parents till later.
Do you think that this was a result, again, now that we have a little more time and distance between this happening, that it was the motive of the mother that moved Koberger to accept this deal?
I still believe in that. I still believe that Koberger finally made his plea deal, finally agreed to a settlement because he feared that his parents would be implicated, that they would have to get on the stand and answer questions under oath, and this could impact them. Plus, of course, the fact that now he wouldn't have to face the long guns of firing squad.
Robin?
You know, I keep going back to trying to understand, you know, where he kind of falls, that being Koberger, in the scope of, you know, because right now the definition of what he did falls in line with mass murder, not serial killer yet. You know, but we keep theorizing, I do at least, you know, that this probably would have continued. And part of that is if he's targeting people, I'm also curious, you know, with the gag order slowly being lifted, but slowly trickling out, in any of the research that you did along the way, I'm going to do the worst thing. I'm going to ask two questions at once. Did you see an escalation? Because a lot of times, you know, there's an escalation of violence, an escalation of resentment and things like that that reached that breaking point, which we didn't quite see. At least that's been documented, that has been released yet. Also, the second part of that is, do you think from what you've seen and the interviews you did, do you think there was anyone that you could identify? You know, you have to do it by name, but do you think he had another target in mind after this?
To the first part of your question about an escalation, yes, there was a dramatic escalation. When he first went out to Washington State, before he even made that journey, he bought the knife and the mask. So in some part of his mind, I believe he was thinking about becoming a monster, thinking about becoming a killer. He goes out to Washington State, and he tries to integrate into the world of normalcy, to become a person who can go to pool parties, who can teach students as a teaching assistant at Washington State. But none of it works. None of it works. And finally, he meets this woman. Doesn't meet her. He sees her, I think, in the Mad Greek restaurant. There's no evidence that he ever followed her on social media. Right. If that existed, it would be out there. If he ever spoke with her, that would be out there. And this is a secret. He focused on her for his own obsessive reasons. Was it her blonde exuberance? Something like that, I believe. And I think down the road, he would have killed again. And I bet his next target would have been another young, vivacious blonde, another rebuke to the world that he was living in. I think the thrill of killing would have left inside him a feeling that he had become what he wanted to be, and he wanted to have that, you know, thumbs up, felt selfie. He wanted to do that again someday.
Yeah, that timeline you highlighted is very critical of him buying those things before he even went out there, before he even met supposedly Maddie at a restaurant that he attended and stuff. So yeah. Thanks for that.
I'm wondering, as more the information comes in, that the gag order has been lifted, and yes, I mean, in theory, would he have killed again? Very likely. Do you think there's going to be evidence that's going to come out that there's other 11, 12 King Road houses out there, essentially, that maybe he was surveilling? Maybe this wasn't the only house that he was sitting outside of late at night, now that we're learning about that, looking in the window of Maddie Mogan. I'm wondering if there's going to be others that are now going to be kind of shocked to think, well, Koberger was also looking at you, too. It just happened to be 1112 King Road. And also, again, two questions. Why settle on this one specifically? Was it just opportunity at the right moment and the right time?
Well, you raise an interesting point. When I was working with Dateline on the special they did, and again, I say working, I had the smallest tangential role, but they found on Koberger's phone photographs of other women, undergraduates at Washington State and also Idaho, University of Idaho. Was she collecting women photographs just for the heck of it, or was he looking for potential targets, his next Maddie? I think one of these women might have been another victim. And if now, if these photographs become revealed, if you can find him being in the vicinity of those, their houses, their dorms, if you can find him stalking them on social media, you can build the case that he would have been able to strike again, and these were his targets.
I mean, a lot of people are wondering, you know, was this just his first time being in a situation like this? And maybe it was in terms of murder, but what we've learned earlier, obviously there was the issue with his cell phone and the dad and him, Hoberger, trying to sell it at the mall kiosk and the dad calling him in for that. But in a new publication, the James Patterson book that has just come out, there's also allegations that he had been stealing from friends of family, that he had gone to a childhood friend's home, and that he was eventually confronted by the mother, who had noticed that things had been missing out of the house, expensive items. This is the time that he was in with his heroin addiction, getting items to sell for money. It seems, I mean, if that is true, Koberger had a little experience being evasive, getting in and out of houses and taking things, going unnoticed. Have you been surprised by that?
No, I mean, it fits the pattern during his heroin junkie years. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a thief. He was doing anything he can to be able to get the drug. What is more interesting to me is he found the strength, the will, the conviction to kick heroin. He was trying to turn his life around, and yet ultimately he couldn't.
Was this exchanging, you know, one addiction for another, essentially trying to find that high? Because obviously something was very missing for him. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on what was the drive over here, off of drugs, over to, I guess, homicidal fantasies, or putting all of his negative emotions and rage against women in this direction. Is it just one addiction for another?
Well, it's an interim step.
Yeah.
In the middle of this step, after giving up drugs, he tried to become a criminal psychologist. He mm-hmm. wanted to become a professor. He tried to aspire to a life where he would integrate himself into normal middle-class life, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be a person of respect who was respected. And yet he couldn't. He tried to meet people at the pool party. He couldn't interact with them ultimately. He just couldn't make that leap. And ultimately, you know, biology is destiny. He had to become what he felt he was intrinsically destined to become, and that was a monster. Becoming a student of criminal justice, that fueled his fantasies. And finally, it got to the point where he had to take action.
In your recent airmail piece, you were alluding to the missteps by law enforcement early on in this case, and some of those perplexing aspects remaining unresolved. With officials that are now free to speak, we've been seeing them speaking somewhat. What sort of investigative missteps or challenges are you most interested in clarifying from early on? You were one of the first on the ground there, really looking into this, kind of getting a fresh perspective before many others did. Do any newly released details, hinted things that police might have done differently during the investigation, or pieces that now are being revealed that may be stronger than they initially thought they were?
Well, early on in the case, Chief Fry was running the investigation, who quickly gave up the job as soon as Koberger was caught. He said there was nothing for people to fear. The students at the University of Idaho didn't have to worry. This was a targeted crime. And that's not true. That mm-hmm. Koberger was still on the loose, and he might well have become a serial killer. Other aspects of the case, the FBI's involvement, the way they, I believe, broke laws to access the genetic inventory databases when they first became involved in the case, that's always been murky. Ann Taylor said she never got a satisfactory answer. I think the FBI was involved way before the December 19th that they said was their official date when they passed on the tip to Moscow. I'd like that to become clear. I'd like to know how and when they first were on to him and when they first started following him and how active they were in Pennsylvania.
Let's talk about that. Your belief that they broke laws. Are you referring to the IgG, the data that was retrieved from those databases versus obviously CODIS didn't have anything in it? Was that the law breaking you're referring to?
Well, yes, and it's not alleged. It came out in the court in motions that the FBI admitted that they accessed databases that they were prohibited from accessing. Some companies like 23andMe do not allow law enforcement to go into their files. And yet the FBI, in their zeal to catch a killer, did that. If they hadn't done that, who knows what would have happened? Koberger still might be on the loose. It was that tip, as they called it, that allowed the Idaho task force to find the car, to make sense of the surveillance videos, and to do the cell phone triangulation.
Was it breaking the law or breaking more of a terms of service? In because I don't know that there's actually there's protocol that says with the FBI, we don't do this, but there's no law, from my understanding, that says we don't do this.
Well, terms of service is a legal term, and I'm certainly not a lawyer. But when you sign an agreement and you assign this agreement with the knowledge that law enforcement can't look at what you're putting into that database, and when they do, that seems to me a violation of the law. Again, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and that could be debated. And lawyers can debate everything, but to me, that's how it seems.
Robin?
As a layman.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I loved when you brought that up in the book as well, Howard, because, you know, I've been so part of investigations for many years that when I was really thinking hard, it's like, all right, here I am. I'm a case agent working this case. Because all you're always trying to do, and this is what it sounds like they did, is how can I work within the law and realize and kind of understand a difference, as you're alluding to a little bit, the difference between law and policy. Is it a policy of the company that we're breaking or a law that we're breaking? And when I was always trying to work, and this might be the case, that's why it'll be interesting to see during the big reveals that are coming about, because I'd like to know it too. Did they have an inside source, a confidential human source inside the genetic companies that voluntarily gave them, when sensitized to their needs, the information, or did they compel them? Because there's always that fine gray line that the legal people in the office are going to go down. It's like, are you breaking a law, or do you have a confident human source voluntarily providing information that they weren't tasked to give? My guess is that they were most likely having a case agent and the attorneys in the office riding that gray line and justifying their actions because they thought it was a righteous cause.
Or, as you point out, did they have a human source who called them and gave them a tip on Koberger, who might have been a member of the family? That's another interesting mystery that will come out. Did someone in the family call the FBI and that push them forward to cross this gray line on the genetic inventory information?
That's what I'm all in on. It's there's always confident human sources that are given the tips, given the information that kind of compel investigators to go down one road or another. So I'm leaning on that one as well, Howard.
There were reports, not officially confirmed due to the gag order, that investigators had found an ID of someone associated with the King Roadhouse. And that's as close as I believe the terminology ever got to putting it on someone or one of the victims at the house, that those IDs were connected to someone amongst Koberger's belongings. Have you heard anything through your sources, Howard, about the alleged ID discovery, if it was ever true, and how significant, obviously would be a major piece of evidence if that was out there? I'm surprised we hadn't heard more about it yet, if in fact it is true.
I've been trying to find out about it, and like you, it would be a major piece of information, a major bit of connective tissue. And I have been able to find out nothing at this point. I don't believe it was the ID from someone in the house, but time will tell. And again, perhaps I think you're thinking wishfully about this outpouring of information. I think it's going to be a slow trickle over the next decade.
Let me ask you about that. I mean, beyond the knife sheath, DNA records, the kind of extenuating pieces that are kind of adding on to pieces that we already knew about. It seems to be what we're seeing a lot of right now. Beyond that, what other physical or forensic evidence that has come out, or statements that people have made since the gag order has lifted that have stood out to you most?
I mean, you were raising all these questions, and I've seen nothing since the gag order has been lifted that makes the case against him any stronger. It's still a mystery. And that's why we come back to the president's statement. You know, will he have to speak? Will he have to say anything? I don't believe he will. But again, this case began in mystery. That's what pulled me into it, the first part. Mm-hmm. And it's going to end with the mystery still outstanding.
It makes you wonder a little bit. Robin, do you have a question?
No, I'm in the same boat. There's so many blank spaces that it'll be interesting to see if Cobra can, over the period of time, kind of like the BTK situation where he's going to keep doing this leakage and keep attention on himself, or he's going to face something other in prison that's going to preclude these disclosures over time. You know, it's like you want one and not the other. One of the greatest mysteries to me is still how he was able to clean everything so well with such a bloody scene, to have zero blood splatter on anything. From what you've heard, do you think that was his exceptional ability to be OCD about cleanliness, or was it any missteps by the investigators to miss it?
I think it was his criminal justice studies that allowed him to do it. That combined with his OCD techniques. I mean, there was so much blood in the house that was dripping out of the foundations. We've all seen the pictures of the red rivulets dripping down the side of the house. And yet there's no trail of blood outside the house. That would have been seen by the investigators. There's nothing in his apartment, nothing in the car. Again, it's a mystery. And I'm sure Ann Taylor would have played those points at her trial over and over again to the jury.
It makes you wonder what we're going to find out about that that specific element of this with information coming out from the prosecution beyond just Ann Taylor. Did they ever figure out how he got away with keeping such a cleanly situation? That to me, that statement that was made.
You know, if the prosecution had anything, why didn't Bill Thompson reveal it in his statement at the plea deal? Again, that plea deal statement introduced nothing except one new bit of information that they too believed that only one of the students was the primary target.
Yeah, very true. I'm curious what we're going to find out here, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on how much of Brian in his mind was trying to emulate, and I'm saying this in air quotes, the greats, if you will, or the most well-known killers of the past. That photo in the shower, to me, right away stood out. It reminded me of not only the movie Psycho and that character, the Norman Bates, but also American Psycho, the movie. The elements of his dress were very similar. The tight white shirt, the smile, the thumbs up. So many things seem to be nods in the way of Koberger to other killers of the past, fake and both real. The thumbs up, the Bundy. Obviously, there's the elements of the Elliot Rodger. We can talk about that in a moment. But do you think we're going to find an obsession here as they dig further into his life and his past and what he was into, of this idea of identifying with very well-known serial killers and somehow then that being the folks he looked up to and part of the motivating factor behind what he was doing, because he wanted to be one of them? It seems that he was putting those nods out there quite a bit, but very few were catching it at the moment.
I think he started out as a student and then he wanted to become one. His teacher, Professor Ramslin, talks about how fantasy breeds the real thing. You want to experience it yourself. And he read all about the serial killers. He fantasized about it. And then he was going to become like them. There are references, conscious and unconscious, to the people he studied. That's part of his MO.
I wonder, did he have his own identity? Because he was so, I'm going to say new to this, it sounds so callous, but new to this world of this sort of thing. Had he gone on, there probably would have been more. But I'm wondering, did he have an identity of his own? Or is Brian Koberger a very interesting subject here? Is he's more of a cornucopia of all these different elements of different killers, all kind of pushed into one, and he's picking and choosing the elements that he wants to be based on that kind of learned behavior.
He's trying to commit, I believe, and this is just me speculating, yeah, hypothesizing, commit the perfect crime. And to commit this perfect crime, he had to take elements of all the people he studied. He did his tutelage, and now this was his doctoral dissertation, in effect.
Do you think there was
all he had learned?
Do you think there was one in particular that stood out to Koberger? Is there anything in his line of thinking that this was the one he idolized the most, or this is the one that he looks back on going, that guy had something going on, whether it be Dennis Rader or whoever it may be?
I think that's too coherent a modus of operandi for him. I think he was taking all this and just reacting as a sense of madness. I mean, we go back to that night, mm-hmm, where he was just circling the house, trying to find the will to do it. And when he finally acts, he pays no attention to the cars in the driveway, the DoorDash driver. He's locked in his own world. Mm-hmm. He's becoming his own monster. And I think this is what was pushing him forward.
Robin?
Yeah, that's perfect of what I wanted to go down next, Howard. From all the, even its limited data points, but the evidence we have of him through his life arc so far, he seems to get really stovepiped. And he doesn't seem, you know, like once he gets fixated on something, he creates a plan just for this. And his ability to innovate new data coming in once he's locked in seems pretty limited. And it seemed like that night, with the exception of this, that's why I was curious about your opinion. If he was targeting just Maddie, and I know people have asked this before, but I'm curious about your opinion, and he's fixated on her, you can maybe then understand why the two in the room, but why four and not five or six? You know, so my curiosity is that he gets so stovepiped, he can't innovate and solve new problems as they're emerging. And so he had a purpose to go in there. He adapted it somewhat on the way, or maybe it was four, but I don't think so. And then why not more?
Well, again, I'm just speculating. But
we all are.
Kelly was in the room. She fought for her life. He had to deal with her. He had to kill her in his mind. Xana comes up the stairs. He now sees her. He has no choice but to deal with her. When he chases her back towards her room, there's Ethan. Now he kills Ethan. Why he started to carve Ethan's legs, as the Dateline episode said, that too is a mystery. Then he sits on a chair and rests for a moment and then goes out. I think during that period of rest, he's still locked in his own thoughts. I don't think he saw Dylan at all. I think if she had spoken up, if she said one word, she too would become another victim. But he just went on his own journey out of the house. He had accomplished what he wanted to accomplish. He was this monster now.
Thank you.
Elliot Roger, another big focus of this case. He, of course, was one of the incel, as the incels call them, what, the supreme gentleman, I think, is the bizarre term that they have for this character. He was obviously another individual that has been compared to Koberger quite a bit. And a lot of people have been wondering, us included, since the beginning, is Koberger an incel? And you get to the definition of incel. Is it someone that's interacting on these online forums, or just a way of thinking? Would you, from everything you've investigated and understanding of what, you know, an incel is, and not just a label, is that the ideology that was behind a lot of Koberger's motives, this hate, this resentment for women that drove his actions?
I don't think so, actually.
No.
I think he tried to find a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. The pool party behavior, he was looking. He just couldn't quite make it. He just didn't have the nerve to do it. I don't think he was an incel who was willing to live his life without women. He kept on trying. And again, just like being a professor, keeps on trying and failing, that hyped up his state to take action.
We've heard some reporting now from individuals who had interacted with him, specifically the WSU police chief, Gary Jenkins, that was interviewed about the hiring Koberger possibly on as an internship. But they didn't hire him due to his awkward social demeanor in smaller terms. In hindsight, I'm curious what your thoughts on that. Does that detail align with what you've learned about Koberger's personality, his traits, his lack of rapport, and everything to not bring him in for even this area of law enforcement?
You know, first, that story by the officer talking, mm-hmm. I mean, that's really stretching a news story. I think he had nothing really to add. The guy was awkward on a Zoom conversation, or his version of mm-hmm. awkward. You know, people can listen to this and say, I'm awkward. I mean, I think they're trying to make something out of nothing. It shows our desperation to get new facts. Now that the gag order has been lifted, I'm waiting for the first substantive revelation. I don't think that was one.
No. Robin?
Yeah, as we keep going through this, and I'm with you, Howard, on the incel, you know, I just didn't see a lot of his fixation on that either. I think he was just being who he was. And the same thing with the gag order. I'm not seeing it in a big outpouring that I've been shocked with so far either. But with everything that we're covering, what would your recommendations be in the sense of, what do you think we've learned from this? What do you think parents can do that can help them feel better about sending their kids off to college? Are there any lessons learned of things that anyone you think missed, or is just guess your best?
I mean, my kids are out of college, but you know, the first thing I would tell them now is lock your door at night. I lock my door at night now. I make sure all the time. I make sure the sliding doors are always locked. Other than that, you learn that life is very precious, and it's a really nasty, precarious world out there, and you really don't have control over it. You send your children off, and then you lose control, and you can just worry. I mean, that's why my heart goes out to these families, to Steve Gonsalves. I can only imagine what he's feeling, and the other families. They're victims, too. They're serving life sentences.
What if you were able to sit down and have a conversation with Koberger at this point, or at any point in the future, information that we don't know about? What are the three questions you would want to ask him, Howard?
Well, I hope that day comes. Yeah. If he's listening, I'd love to speak with you. I'll go to visit you wherever you are. Mm-hmm. First question is why. Why did you want to become a killer? Second question again is why? Why these children, students, and then why at this point in your life did you finally feel you had to do this?
What kind of reaction, what kind of answers do you think you would get from him if you were just to theorize?
I think there will be a time in his life where he'll be very introspective. I think he will share things. Might not be for a while. It might not be to me, but I think there'll be a time in his life where he'll want to talk, where he'll want to make sense of all this. I mean, he's a graduate student. Mm-hmm. He studied how criminals worked, how criminal minds worked. We all know those questions that he asked for his master's thesis that he sent out to people in jail. I think he'll start to ask those questions of himself, and he'll work out some sort of answers. He'll have plenty of time to think.
Lots to unpack. Robin?
So as we're kind of going through the arc of his life and where it's at now, what do you think, again, just from your experience, what do you think the life behind bars and prison is going to be like for him? Is it going to be smooth, not smooth? The worst thing that everyone thinks is he's going to enjoy it. What do you think?
I think he will enjoy the fact of a sheltered situation where it's under control, where he can read and study, and he can become a forensic psychologist. He can think about his own crime and become a peer of all the people he aspired to. How the jail population will treat him, that would be up to the Idaho authorities, how much protection they will give him, how isolated they will keep him. I don't know how successfully they can do that.
Certainly, I would imagine he will be a target behind bars. And I think that's a concern for some. And I think it's something some are looking at going, great, he'll be a target behind bars. It will be fascinating to see how that all plays out over time. Howard Bloom, Robin Drake, thank you guys both for joining us. Howard Bloom, New York Times bestselling author, the book When the Night Comes Falling. You can also check out his very compelling articles on airmail. And Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agency for the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Thank you both again, as always, for coming on and giving us your insights.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Workplace stress is now a leading cause of declining mental health, with 61% of the global workforce feeling it more than ever. You can't escape work, but you can take small steps to care for yourself. A walk, some sun, a favorite song. Therapy is one of those steps, ongoing support to build resilience for whatever your day throws at you. Balance is tough. Getting help shouldn't be. Visit BetterHelp.com today for 10% off your first month.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spend on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. LifeLock is here with tips to help protect your identity. Use strong passwords, set up multi-factor authentication, report scams, and update your software. And for comprehensive identity protection, LifeLock is your best choice. LifeLock alerts you to suspicious uses of your personal information and fixes identity theft, guaranteed, or your money back. Start your protection today with a 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Use promo code NEWS. Terms apply.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.